Happy Friday evening, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. I'm proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight is a very special night. Two of my favorite authors are here to discuss writing, publishing, thrillers, dystopian, post-apocalyptic, and probably other stuff that I have no idea what. Steve Conkley is a best-selling thriller novelist and post-apocalyptic writer. His current book is called Fractured State. It is on my short list this year for Book of the Year. The other author that's with us is Tom Abrams, who is what he calls himself a hybrid author. And I guess that's because he writes in so many different genres, but, you know, you can always call in and ask him. He writes post-apocalyptic thrillers, action adventure, and political conspiracies. I just finished reading his book, Intention. It is amazing. Another book on my short list for Book of the Year. I'm so happy to turn over the microphone tonight to two guys who I really admire a lot, Steve Conkley and Tom Abrams. Steve, I'm going to let you take it away, and I'm going to sit back and listen. Have a good show.
Thank you very much, Pam. So I've never met Tom before. This is the first I've ever heard of him tonight. I'm absolutely kidding. Maybe the best thing to do would to start out, kind of explain how we met each other, and got to be such great writer buddies. What do you think about that, Tom?
I think it's a great place to start. And I think we originally met because I had released Sedition in late 2012, which was my first published novel, and was looking for support from other successful, successful, not other successful, because at that point I certainly wasn't, authors who might be willing to help me a little bit. And I reached out to you, and you were really generous and said, I'll read your book. If I like it, I'll write a review. If I don't, I'll just tell you I don't like it, but I won't publish anything about it. And you read it pretty quickly, and we started talking politics. I think ever since then you've been a huge help and guiding force in my fledgling career.
Now, I remember when you reached out to me. It was I had no idea why. Why you were asking me, and I was very flattered, and you remember it exactly. I distinctly, I'm so skittish sometimes with reading books, but just from talking to you and checking out the premise, I'm like, I think I'm gonna really love this book, and I absolutely did. Sedition was just a fantastic novel, and had one of my favorite characters, Sir Spencer, which I think I, over the past 4 years, have been begging you to return to the fold, which you have. You've actually done it and woven him into a number of books, the Jackson Quick books, and Allegiance, Allegiance Burn, Hidden Allegiance, which are all out now, and now back. I haven't read Intention, but I'm hoping he's around there. Actually, he may not be.
No, he's in Intention. So.
Oh, perfect.
Because Intention essentially is, builds on the conspiracy that begins in Sedition, and hopefully it's a better book because I've written so many since then. But I reached out to you, I think, in part because of the success of your Black Flag novels. I saw that you wrote, kind of thrillers, Then I also had read Jakarta Pandemic and really liked it. And so I thought, since there were a lot of political undertones too, I think, to Jakarta Pandemic, and so that was part of the reason that I thought you might be a good person who would reject me after I asked for help, but you didn't.
I'm so glad, so very glad I didn't. That would have been a big judgment lapse on my part. I think it's interesting that we both we really did start out in thrillers. I mean, when I've been writing a number of years in post-apocalyptic and dystopian with the Perseid Collapse series, and the Jakarta Pandemic falls into that category. Although it's a lot of suspense and has a lot of thriller elements, but that is where we met. And it's interesting how we both have shifted over time into the post-apocalyptic dystopian genre. And expanding on that, not stealing your thunder, but I think your first jump into that was an extremely successful launch into the Percy of Collapse Kindle world. You wrote three novellas, the Pilgrimage series, and they were fantastic. I mean, do you feel like that, did that kind of, did that embolden you, or, you know, how did that impact your eventual landing in the post-apocalyptic dystopian genre?
It really did impact, you know, kind of where I wanted to take my writing future. I stopped writing Intention, or maybe it was the last Allegiance book, I can't remember, but I stopped whatever I was writing when you asked me to write in your Kindle world, in Percy Collapse Kindle world, and I thought, you know, all these other guys you've asked have all written pretty much in this genre, or they already have a huge fan base. I don't have either of those attributes. So I thought the only way maybe I could stand out a little bit was to write more than one, because I had read that people like to binge read, like they like to binge watch movies and TV shows. So I talked to you about that. You liked the idea of there being more than one. And so I basically, you know, I tried to stick as close to your storyline as I could with brand new characters. And that was as much to challenge myself as it was to make everything familiar to your readers, so that somebody could pick up my three novellas and read them and not have read your stuff, and then go read yours because they liked what I wrote, or fans of yours would see all the little nods I gave to what was going on in
yep.
your series. And yeah, that really, I think, when I saw that it had some success, although certainly it was relative success, but when I saw it had some success, I thought, you know, and you had been suggesting that I write in a post-apocalyptic genre, I finally decided that's what I'm going to do. I'd finished Intention. I was looking for my next book. I'm probably about 6,000 words into my next political book, but stopped it when I came up with an idea for Home and started writing that series. And so I was shocked, I think, as you were, and everybody else, that anybody actually picked up the book and read it. But it really jump-started what was just a hobby and has made it somewhat of a second career.
That's awesome. And you know, the Traveler series, so you have Home, Canyon, Wall, which you published. I mean, really, you published those books within a six-month period.
Yes, I did.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking that's fast for you, but I was starting to see that speed coming up when you were writing the Kindle world, and you know that's always a good sign when you're writing faster, you're still writing the same quality, but you're really I could tell that you were onto something in this genre by when you were writing the Pilgrimage series for the Kindle world, and so do you want to talk a little bit about the Home? I mean, you're very modest in terms of the success level. I mean, the Traveler series is, I mean, really, it's one of the, it's a runaway hit, a post-apocalyptic hit of 2016. I mean, you watched in December of last year, and then it picked up steam, and it's just been going like gangbusters. So it's absolutely amazing.
Well, thanks. I mean, it slowed a little bit lately, but it's also been, I guess, like 8 months now. And still, it doesn't feel real. You know, Home, it was funny because my wife and I started having bets. Once it broke 1,000, we were like, okay, well, it's not going to break 900. It's not going to break 800. And I'm talking about the overall rank on Amazon. It's not going to break 700. And then it got to 100, which was just bizarre without any promotion or anything. It was selling like crazy. And most people, you know, 3 out of 4 like it. And I pre-sold, and I think its success is what drove me to get the next book out faster.
Sure.
And one criticism people have of turning books quickly is that, well, how can the quality be good if you're turning out 3-4 books a year? And our mutual friend Russell Blake has said, what does it matter how quickly you do it if you put in the same number of hours? And so what I've found is that each book still has the same number of man hours put into it. It's just that I'm spending more hours per day putting those, instead of writing, you know, 500 words a day, I'm writing 1,500 to 2,000 words a day. And that enables me to get them out faster. They still go through the same editing and the same proofreading and all that. It's just, once I saw Home doing well, I knew I had to get the second one out quickly because people forget. And so that's why I wrote them as quickly as I did, or why I was as diligent as I was about writing every day to make sure that the audience that I had, I didn't lose. And I actually think I was on the verge of losing it a little bit with Wall. It took, you know, almost 4 months after Canyon to get Wall out, and I did notice a little bit of a dip. And I think that's because it's the beginning of the summer and people are picking up what they're going to get for the summer and I think you could talk about this at length, that's the challenge as an author now. Unless you have the backing of a large publishing company who is going to promote the living daylights out of you for your one book a year, you really do have to put out 3 books a year to remain relevant.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that, especially when you're with a self-published series, and you know, you also set an expectation. So you have your readers, and they get the 2 books within a quick span of time. I've faced that challenge a lot in the past. You know, the Black Flag books. Back then I was working a full-time job, and I was getting 2 out a year, which was as fast as I could do. But I know if I had just added 1 more book per year, those books would have gone to the next level. I was convinced of it, and that's really why I quit my job and started writing full-time in the fall of 2013. And I closed up that series, the Black Flag books, and then I moved on to the Perseid Collapse books because, after writing 4 books in the series, you know, it was time for a little break. I never expected that break to be another 3 years, you know, from that series, but it's what it turned out to be. And, you know, it's hard to maintain that pace. I think, I signed with Thomas and Mercer partly in a way to get a break from that. The publishing schedule is expanded, and I don't know if that's been good or bad for me. It certainly hasn't hurt, book sales, and I think my brand in general. But it does. I do miss those. I miss that. I know you have an incredible work ethic, and I get jealous because I look at the books as they're coming out, and I'm like, boy, I'm just not at that same writing level, and I'm trying to get back into that. So you've been a big motivation in that way.
Well, but you also have a library of books already. You have a back catalog of books that I didn't have. And I think actually I probably suffered from that. When Home hit, had I already had 2 or 3 other books in that genre, I think I would have, because we both noticed, and this is in part because of the way Amazon works, we both benefit from the Kindle World books. We both noticed an enormous jump. Ridiculously enormous jump in the Kindle World's books that I'd written, because people wanted something else I'd written in post-apocalyptic. That did not translate, really, to any of my political thrillers. They didn't see much of a bump at all.
Yeah, that's interesting, and I see the same thing. I mean, it's I think what you'll see is a gradual crossover, but it's not an automatic. It's not just an intuitive. The genres are very different, and that's something, we can talk about a little later, about, the vast difference between, the challenges writing in each one, but also the challenge in reaching readers. I've had a good, a good amount of crossover, but it's very clear that I agree with you. It's, having a big sale and a big boost in one does not necessarily translate over to the next one.
And what is your take on pre-sales? Do you think they help you or not? Speaking of not just crossover, but from one book to the next.
I think so. I mean, I think you demonstrated that it works pretty well. I mean, it's I was always part of the original or beta program for pre-orders, and I took advantage of it. But I did feel like you kind of lost out on that pop that first day, readers list. You spend all this time building up a big reading list or a mailing list, and then you send that out, and then that's not my dog, by the way. Just kidding.
No, it's my dog, and I'm like in a room with a door shut, but for some reason our Wheaton is an absolute monster. So I can mute it while you talk.
That's fine. I've all my kids and dog, they're all locked away right now. Not in any kind of an illegal fashion or DHS type of concern area, but
Well, they might be.
Yeah, yeah, maybe. my house is unnervingly quiet tonight, actually. So talking about the genres, you know, they're, you know, for me, making the jump from the Black Flag books to the Percy Collapse books, it was a really, it was a big shift. I had not written in the post anything in that kind of post-apocalyptic vein in a while, and you know, it took me a long time to get that first book out, a lot longer than I thought it would. But once it went, boy, that genre—it was hot then, and it, I think it might be even hotter now. And it's something I'd love to talk to you about. You know, why you think that's the case. You know, in your second life or your primary life, you know, you cover politics, and you know, we've talked about it at length. You know, why do you think that this genre is just, you know, continuing to be booming?
Well, I think, you know, I think people like thinking about the end of the world and what they would do. And as our mutual editor, Felicia Sullivan, would say, people like stories of survival. And I think that translates into Hollywood. It translates into books. People have, I mean, the end of the Bible, you know, the New Testament is about the end of the world, right? And so I think at a very fundamental level, people like thinking about the end of the world in the same way that they like going to scary movies. How would I react? What would I do? It's very easy to find a hero and a villain in a vacuum of an apocalypse. And so I think, you know, people devour that in a way that maybe political thrillers, as much as people love them, sometimes they're too close to home or they're too realistic. People like the escapism of imagining the end of a world and what they would do. You know, I think, I mean, that's my take on it. And I think you're absolutely right when you say that it's hot and it's maybe hotter than it's been. The one criticism I think that all of us probably find from some readers is that, oh, well, I've read this before. And so the challenge is coming up with a new and inventive way to tell the same story that's been told countless times. And I think you did that really successful with Perseid Collapse, in the way that you combined a couple of, I don't want to give the story away, but you had a traditional element that a lot of people write about, and then you had, right, you combined two things essentially at the same time that made your story very, and then you combined the military aspect of it with it, and it was very unique in that way, and that's, I think, why it resonated so well for so long with so many people over so many books.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I hear that. I start to blush. You can't really see me blushing on the air, but I am right now. I agree. You know, you said, what would I do? I think that has always been the key for me to this genre, is that I really think when people read, unlike thrillers, like political thrillers, I see as more voyeuristic. You know, they're looking in, almost like you're watching a show, you're reading a book. You're seeing what they're doing, and that's cool. You know, wow. You involve a little tech in there. You know, snapping necks, whatever it is. I think people look at it from like, what can the author do with these characters? But the post-apocalyptic books, I mean, I really think it's people. I think when they read it, they're really just feeling it a little more. They're picturing themselves in that mix, and that's why I think some of the more successful, my character in the Percy Collapse is a little more of a superhero-ish. That is, one complaint, that I will accept and nod and say, yeah, you know, he's definitely very capable. But a lot of the books have like just regular folks, you know, just facing really kind of difficult, almost insurmountable things happening to them, catastrophes, you name it. And I think people like to kind of envision that and root for those people and move forward with them. So it was interesting you said that. And you know, I appreciate you saying the Perseid Collapse is different, because I had a lot of people after the Jakarta pandemic, they wanted to see Alex Fletcher. They wanted him back. And it's just from one book, but it's a recurring theme in the emails. And I thought, there's no way I'm bringing him. You can't. No, I'm not bringing him back. I'm not doing the diehard John McClane, how many times can John McClane be at the wrong place at the wrong time, or the right place at the right time? You know, I told myself, if I bring them back, it's going to be something it's got to be something big that hasn't been done before. Now, EMP, you know, it's been done before, but I think the way I went about it was different enough that, you know, it worked.
Well, and I think that was my hope with the Traveler series was I live in Texas. I wanted to do something a little different. And, you know, Franklin Horton, who also writes in this series and has a new book out, and he didn't pay me to say that, he compared Home in some way to Cormac McCarthy's The Road. And I kind of, you know, I mean, which was like a huge compliment, but I kind of, you know, Cormac McCarthy's books, a lot of them have a Western bent to them. And so that's kind of the idea that I had was a stylized Western in the apocalypse. And in some ways, it's not necessarily realistic because the bad guys use shotguns when they have access to other weapons. But I did that for the effect of it feeling like a Western. And the bad guys wear different color cowboy hats, you know, to identify, you know, where they are within the evil organization. I wanted that Western post-apocalyptic feel, and I didn't see a lot of books out there like that. And so that's why I wrote it that way. I also wanted to write it years after the event had happened. I didn't want,
right.
And that I thought was a little different. And so then the question becomes after I was done with that series, or at least I've taken a break after three books, is what do I do next that's different? And that's not an easy thing.
Right. No, this is a great kind of segue into something I thought we might talk about a little later, but no time like the present. So you did create this very unique world, which I think is, you know, I hate to use the word niche, like you find a niche because niche makes it sound small. It's very unique. And, I think it's a place, it's fertile ground, and you're going to see more books written, you know, more series written in this kind of style. So I'd love to talk about world building because, you know, for both of us in our last series, so Fractured State is, you know, it's a near future. I think yours is 2039. Am I right?
Mine's like 20 years from it. So like 2036, 2037,
right.
Something like that. So yeah, so it's 20 years in the future.
Right. So and mine was that was exactly what I did. I set mine 20 years out. I wanted a near future, something recognizable but not alien. So my world is it's like sleek, high tech. You know, there's still Starbucks. There's all the things that everyone would recognize today. But you know, I just had the most fun with this series of all my series coming up with this world. I mean, I spent my wife always she's like, "Are you writing it?" You know, I'm like, "No, I'm just one more timeline, one more map, one more this and." It drives her crazy because she's like, just start writing. But I just have so much fun building the world. So I build this, you know, near future, you know, high tech world. And you did, you know, yours is set in the same time frame, but your world is just as complex, but it's so different. I mean, it's I was thinking about it today. I'm like, it's absolutely amazing. And I know you spent just as much time because, you know, I could see the maps. You know, you have everything, you know, the towns, the roads, the, you know, everything is mapped out. And there's such a hierarchy, and there's it's a very deep world. So did I just say everything that needed to be said? Sorry.
No. It's funny because we have different processes
mm-hmm.
in that, like, I know that you go through before you write a book and you have a board that you use to kind of plot things out, sort of an idea of where the book is going. You know, you're very organized that way. And I think I notice when you build your world too, you've got every little thing. I mean, I remember reading a blog post you wrote about what you were going to call cell phones. 20 years in the future, what were they going to be called? I don't work that way. I appreciate the credit you're giving me, but I don't work that way.
Wait,
really. I start writing, and then as I'm writing, I'm making notes about what I've written so that I can stay consistent.
Right.
And then the world kind of builds as I'm going. And sometimes I'll make a mistake and I have to go back and fix it. And I'll, some, you know, either I'll catch it or a beta reader will catch it. But I kind of build the world as I'm going. And the way I write is I kind of have at the bottom of whatever it is I'm writing, I have these just like notes, like one sentence about where the book is going to go next. And it's like maybe, you know, the next 10 or 15 chapters. Maybe it's the whole thing, but I just have one line, you know, just this is what's going to happen in this chapter. And oftentimes that changes significantly. I add things, I subtract things, or I'm like, oh, I haven't heard from this character in a while. But my world building is in a lot of ways kind of almost accidental in that as I build, as I'm writing it, it kind of forms as opposed to me taking a lot of smart time to figure it out ahead of time. So that when I'm writing, the world is there and I just have to fill in the blanks. And I actually think that's in some way why it's much easier to write in Kindle worlds than it is to write your own novel, because the world has already been built. You just, it's a paint by numbers, and you just have to pick the right colors to fill in as opposed to creating it from scratch.
Gentlemen, I need to interrupt for a second. You have a caller online on area code 770. Would you like to go ahead and take the call?
I think that's a banned area code. I'm just kidding. Yeah.
There you go. Okay, area code 770. You're on the air with Steve and Tom. Go ahead, please.
Good evening, gentlemen. This is Randy. How are you this evening?
Randy.
Good. How are you, Randy?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It has it's been wonderful listening to you two talk about creating worlds and especially the Kindle worlds. I've really enjoyed hearing exactly how you guys think about the process and how you go through it. I find it very helpful. But my main question, my main reason for calling in, not to get you too far off track, and since you're talking about post-apocalyptic and the genre and things like that, my good friend Steven is used to me asking him how his Frito supply is doing. And I was just curious, Tom, how is your Frito supply? And since you've moved into the post-apoc genre, has that impacted how you live your life? Do you do things any differently? Do you take any kind of steps as far as preparedness are concerned?
Yes and no. I mean, not as much as I should. I'll be the guy that dies in the first 5 minutes. Hopefully my family lives a lot longer. Because we live in Southeast Texas, and because as a journalist I've covered hurricanes and I know what happens when the power goes out for a long time, and after Hurricane Ike we lost power for a long time. We're generally seasonally prepared for hurricanes. I mean, we have extra water, we have a generator, we have a lot of dry goods. But I'm not nearly as well prepared as some of the characters in my books. But it's always something that we work towards. I mean, we're not as unprepared as a lot of people, I think in part because of where we live, but we could certainly be better prepared. My Frito supply is probably not long enough, but I have enough cheese whiz to go along with it that we'd be okay for a while.
Yeah. And Randy, this is Steve. We cut out processed foods last year, so I don't have any Fritos on hand. So for those that don't know, this is Randy Powers from Practical Tactical. He's a co-author with me on a book called Practical Prepping, No Apocalypse Required. Randy's a good friend, and that's a great question, the Frito supply. I always want to know, you know, that's good to know, Tom. You're 5 minutes in. I think now at this point I'm 2 hours maybe. I don't know.
You know, I'm 5 minutes because my wife always jokes, but it's not really a joke. And she says, you know, when the world ends, you're going to have to go cover it, and I'm going to be here alone. And that's
a good point.
Probably true.
You
well,
know,
may
Tom,
I also interject right now and just say that not only is Randy Powers a terrific guy when it comes to preparedness, he is also a host in the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network of the show called Practical Prepping, period. So for those of you who want to learn some common sense information about it, please go to the Facebook page called Practical Prepping, period. Randy, thanks for calling in. Do you have another question?
I just had one quick thought or comment about
please,
what Tom
please
said.
Please do. Please.
Because being having a journalist background myself, statement about having to leave your wife and go do it, you know, go cover it, I completely
mm-hmm.
commiserate with that. And that's part of the reason that we had to get Alice squared away so she could handle
there
this.
There you go. Thank you
awesome.
So much, Randy. Have a great evening, and please continue to listen, okay?
Okay, y'all. Have a good night.
Thanks, Randy.
Thanks, Randy. You're awesome.
Tom, I have a question for you. It was interesting to me that you said that you kind of took a Western, a la Westerns, perspective when you were writing your post-apocalyptic books. I find that to be very relevant and to be very spot on, because I think that at that time, people could only depend on themselves. They had to learn to be self-sufficient. There were not modern conveniences that we think about nowadays. So if you're completely off the grid, that was a normal thing for those in the Western times. Do you think that's why you look at your books with that slant?
It could be. It's also, I like Westerns. I mean, it's as simple as that.
But go.
I think so I knew I wanted the guy to be set in Texas, and I wanted the book to be set in Texas. And as I started writing it, it just felt very natural. I mean, I wrote the opening scene with the main character perched in his kid's treehouse.
Right.
And it just, as I wrote it, I felt like it needed to have a Western bent. And so that's why I almost maybe went a little bit overboard with the horses and the kinds of weapons. But if you read all three of the books, you begin to understand why they only use the shotguns and why they only
right.
use horses at certain points.
Well, I have to say, I have read all three books. All three are excellent. I'm sending this out into the, you know, internet universe. All the books are very, very good. I've given all of them 5 stars, as are Steve Conkley's. I want to just take a station break here to remind everyone this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. If you want to call in and say hi to Tom and Steve or ask questions about their dystopian post-apocalyptic books or their thrillers, writing process, anything else, please feel free to do so at 347-633-9609. And hopefully Steve will pay attention when I send him a message. Thanks. Back to you, Tom and Steve.
you just got chastised.
I know. I did. I don't know why I'm getting chastised. All right. I'm looking for the message. Anyways, so now it's time for there we go. Okay, yeah, you did have a question. All right, anyways. I'm paying attention here. Tom, what do you have to say at this moment?
Sure. Well, we were talking about you know, world building,
yeah.
and I think that's certainly
right.
a significant thing. People either buy into your world or they don't, and if they do, they're along for the ride the whole time. If they don't, they check out. And I think it is interesting. I think that there are so many different takes on what the future will look like. You know, there's the Cormac McCarthy version of it, and then there's the Stanley Kubrick version of it, and it's fascinating to think about which one we would find ourselves in. Do you think you write this high-tech kind of future because that's the kind of future you really envision, or is that the kind of future you'd like to see, or where you find yourself most comfortable when you envision yourself dealing with the apocalypse?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and it's certainly a combination of all of it. I just absolutely love thinking about, you know, the future technology, how it can be incorporated into our lives. And, of course, I'm writing about, like, covert operations groups, you know, like really dark black ops teams and how they would utilize it to take advantage of, you know, the situation and, you know, do the nasty things that they do. So I think it's also partly, you know, I write a lot about surveillance, you know, drones, you know, it's probably a little bit of fear in a way, kind of reflecting maybe what I don't want to see.
how I don't want it to turn out. Oddly enough, in my book, I don't have I chose deliberately not to incorporate autopilot, you know, cars. The cars are very, very high tech inside. You know, you're wearing visors that give, you know, MapQuest goes to an entirely different level inside these cars, and ever, you know, especially the high end cars that these groups are using, and even the average person. But it's funny, you know, when over a year ago when I was envisioning this, I was just having this real difficulty picturing autopilot being something that is just absolutely standard, even 20 years in the future. And people may disagree with me, but, you know, if you've been watching the news lately, you know, there's been some challenges. And, you know, I think the consensus right now, and even from some of the, I think, I don't know if the Elon Musk, some of these guys that are, you know, absolute visionaries, have said that, you know, this is probably not going to be a take your hands off the wheel reality day in, day out for another 30 years. So I love thinking about this stuff. I labor over it, especially in the book. Like you mentioned, I spent hours and hours with myself and my developmental editor talking about what do we call cell phones in the future. I'm like, they can't be called cell phones. And we eventually came back to the, you know, working with everyone that we don't want to make it too crazy for people, so I'll call them cell phones in the stories, but I'm convinced that they won't be called that later. So, I absolutely enjoy it. It's something I enjoy doing, but I think it's because I'm kind of envisioning how it will impact me.
That's interesting. And I think that's how people who spend that much time world building, ultimately, you know, people say all the time, are you an objective journalist? And I say, well, there's no such thing as an objective journalist, because nobody can be objective about anything, because they all carry their own life experience into whatever it is they do. And every story that I tell on television or in a book, I'm bringing my own life experience into. The best thing I can do on television is be fair and present all sides. And I think that's the same in a book. I think you, even though the characters don't represent me, you know, I'm not Marcus Battle, the main character of my book. I'm not Jackson Quick. I'm certainly not Matty Harold. I'm not any of those people. And they don't necessarily agree with my view of things. They're made up, but I do.
No, they're
think,
not.
Yeah, right. I even actually once had another author say, well, if the way that character speaks is how you feel about things, then I think we approach the world from different political views. Like, and that guy was an author and thought that that's how I think. But, and I guess I understand. But the only thing I think the world and the way I view it maybe is comes from me. And it, you know, there's a darkness to the apocalypse. Clearly, I mean, that I think comes from my own cynical belief in people. and how there are good people, and they will struggle against, you know, the vast majority of people who aren't necessarily who have self-serving interests, and I think that, you know, I think most post-apocalyptic books go there one way or another, whether it's a high-tech black ops group or, you know, some criminal gang, or just, you know, people who are out of food and what they'll do. And maybe that gets back to the very beginning when we were talking about why do people like books about the apocalypse, because ultimately they're about human nature.
Right. It's so funny. You know, we could probably spend two shows talking about this very interesting dynamic between readers and apparently other authors who take what's written literally as what we believe. And I what you said just encapsulates the whole thing perfectly, because, like, for me, like, the characters represent the story. I mean, I write the characters absolutely. They fit within the story. I mean, yeah, I mean, do they share some of my beliefs? Probably. I mean, it's hard not, like you said, it's absolutely impossible not to put that in there, but I really go through pains, and with the beta readers and with everyone, I'm like, I don't want these characters, the characters themselves, to have a political slant, so to say, you know, a bet, unless that
unless they're just absolutely built into the story for that reason. But I think the worldview and the overall tone of the story, like you said, I think that's where, like, our vision, our kind of where our mind are, our psyche, subconscious, that's where that comes out. And, like, you know, so maybe that doesn't speak very well of me that I write these books about, you know, government, you know, out of government, outside of government agencies, just running amok and, you know, killing and murdering and influencing, you know, events throughout the country, or, you know, the world going to pots and everyone just shooting each other at first sight. So, you know, it probably represents I probably need some therapy. It's interesting. And I absolutely love, like, I just quit letting them get to me. I don't even really acknowledge them anymore. But the reviews that are like, you know, like they say the same thing, like, you know, the author doesn't know what he's talking about with this. You know, the fact that that character did that, you know, shows that this author has no idea about the Constitution, you know, stuff like that. You know, I'm like, it's like a Friday the 13th movie. We all know if the lights go out in the house, you do not go in the basement alone to check the breaker. It's common sense, but the movie would suck if, like, they said, you know what, all 10 of us, we should just sit in this room with all the weapons we can get from the kitchen and just wait this out or walk out of here. You know, so I, you know, we've talked about it before, and I could go on and on, but it's, you know, you take that stuff, and you can take it personally, but I love hearing it.
So, what completely implausible things are you working on now?
So, good point. So, right now, I'm in between books in the Fractured State series. I'll be starting book three. I don't have a name for it yet. And that'll happen, that'll kick off at some point in the mid-fall. Right now I'm actually working on Black Flag 5, or it may be Black Flag Covenant, Black Flag something 1. I'm kind of re-envisioning this series. This book takes place a couple years after the events of the last book, and I'm actually looking for a way to kind of bring Jessica and Daniel Petrovich into their own light as, like, an independent team that has their own series, or, you know, does their own thing. What do you
Very cool. On? And when can the readers who've been asking you almost daily for a next Black Flag book, when can they expect that might be available?
Hold on one second. I have to send the password, the special passcode to my wife, which means that we have to, like, move locations again. That's why I moved to Indiana, by the way. In case anyone doesn't know, I've been putting off readers for 3 years, and it just got to the point where, you know, the torches and pitchforks, it was, I had to.
Well, my dad is one of your fans, and he's always asking me when is the next one coming out. So
if everything goes according to plan, which it probably won't, I would absolutely love to get this into the hands of readers, in late October, November. If it doesn't go exactly to plan, it'll happen very early in the year.
Well, that's not
2017.
No,
it's not long, but it has been a long wait, and I appreciate the reader's patience, because I have been saying, literally, I think every 6 months, oh, it'll be out in 6 months. So thanks for reminding me of that.
No problem.
So what are you working on now?
I'm working on two things. Right now, I'm actually working on another Kindle Worlds book. This one for Nicholas Sansbury Smith's world that comes out in October, based on his Extinction Cycle series. And it's probably darker than anything I've written, because of, you know, the monsters that are in his book. But it's a lot of fun, and it'll be a full length novel. It'll be right around 200, maybe a few more pages than that. And like I did with your series, I'm taking one little element of something that he talks about early in the book and building a story around it. And so I'm kind of telling the story of Patient Zero and what he did for 10 years in the jungles of Vietnam during the 1970s, and then the effort to capture him and bring him back to the United States. So that's the story I'm writing.
Very cool.
It's fun. But I've never, you know, I've never spent so much time in Vietnam on Google Maps as I have in the last in the last few weeks. And that one I'll have done, you know, in a few weeks. I finished draft one of Spaceman, which is my next post-apocalyptic series. And I'm just waiting on a couple beta readers to get back to me, and then I'll send that off for editing. But that basically is about an astro. Well, I tell three parallel stories as a coronal mass ejection larger than any has hit before hits the Earth. It also hits the International Space Station, clearly, since it hits Earth. And the hero in the book is an astronaut who's on board the ISS when the CME hits. And a CME is, you know, similar to an EMP from the sun. And so when it hits, the space station is damaged. He's stuck up there alone and has to figure out a way, without communication back to Earth, how to get home. And at the same time, I'm telling the story of what his wife is going through in her neighborhood when the power goes out. And then the story of his son, who is on a camping trip, and the son's friend and father trying to get back to their home. So it's three parallel stories at the same time.
Cool.
And the first book takes place all within the course of about a day and a half.
Right.
So, we'll see. It's a little more science fiction-y than what I wrote before. And so I'll be interested to see if science fiction fans like it, or if it's just post-apocalyptic fans that like it, or if I turn off everybody.
Well, you're in the hub of NASA, so, and from what I understand, you've had some pretty in-depth research and help. I mean, if you want to call it help, but you've enlisted some heavies within the industry to kind of keep things straight, which is fantastic. I mean, it may be lost on some people, but I honestly don't think it is. I don't think you can, you know, getting things right, it just makes the story flow. So I'm very much looking forward to Spaceman.
Well, thanks. And speaking of getting things right, there are very few guns in this book, which is what I consistently seem to mess up no matter how much research I do.
I think we need to send you to like one of those gun camps or something. So that's so funny.
Right.
That's fantastic. Pam, did you
talk about Rogue State, because that's the next Fractured State book that's coming out. And the cover, I just saw the cover. Looks awesome.
Right. So I did. I delivered the final proof copy of Rogue State to my editor. And, I'm really looking forward to it. So, you know, you mentioned this Western kind of feel and tone. So Fractured State is very high tech. It's set in Southern California. It's you know, there's a lot of military with it, so you're constantly surrounded by new and kind of shiny, sleek stuff. Rogue State is actually very different. It picks up exactly where Fractured State stopped, and it takes place mostly in Mexico and Arizona, a little bit in Nevada, which in this book is known as the Wasteland. So this is an area of the country that has been decimated by the drought. It's subject to the constant dust storms. It's essentially kind of the tail western end of the new Dust Bowl that has arisen because of this historic drought. So it very much a feel from your Traveler series, where it's kind of almost like Mad Max on the road. It has... There's still a lot of technology because it's still available to them, but it has a completely different feel, honestly, than the first book. Same characters, obviously, and they go through a lot of changes that they definitely metamorphosized from the first book.
And you said you've already started building the third one or working on the third one. You have an idea of where it'll go? Will it go back to the high tech? Will it be a mix of the both? Will it?
It'll it'll definitely go back. It's funny, the story kind of expands in scope, and I had not planned that at first, but when I realized what was happening, I'm happy to take credit for that. So the third book, it expands the scope politically. you know, technologically, it definitely, the stuff that happens is, it's just on such a bigger scale than the first two books, but it's, I have it all plotted out, as you know, and things change. I have my board and that, board of post-it notes, and I use post-its for a reason because I move them around, and I tear them down and I put new ones up, and nothing's set in stone, but I'm very happy where I think it's going to end and how that ending is going to be achieved. It's just, it's going to be a catharsis for all the characters, and it's really going to just be a reshaping of the southwestern United States as it's known in the Fractured State series. So
that's exciting.
Gentlemen, I have, we're coming to almost an end to our show, but I do have my usual final five questions for each of you. Are you ready?
Uh-oh.
Five quick questions,
yep.
Five quick answers,
okay.
AKA Stump the Author, right? Okay, Tom Abrams, you are now balancing two very interesting creative careers, one as a television journalist, traveling all over the country and probably the world, and also as a very successful author. What have you learned about yourself since you started writing?
I'm a masochist.
He is. He's got to be. He has to be.
There you go. Steve,
yep.
Is that what it is, really? Is that what you think you're crazy for it, huh?
Yep, I'm crazy. That's pretty much what I've learned.
Would you like Tom to eventually sit down and just write books? I know you love your job. I know you are well thought of in your television career. I know that you are very, very popular. And but can you see yourself sitting down to write books full time?
I'd love to, probably in retirement. And maybe retirement will come a little earlier than it would have otherwise. But, as long as I can juggle both, and pay for college for two kids, I'll keep doing both.
Oh, God, you've got to get another job. McDonald's must be hiring then if you're going to go ahead and pay for college for two kids. Jesus,
and
it's crazy out there. Yeah.
Pam, just to let you know, everyone in Houston knows who Tom is. He acts like he's...
I know.
Like no one knows him, but Tom, where did I run? I ran into someone. They're from Houston. Like I'm like, do you know Tom? I'm like, oh, Tom, on TV. I'm like, absolutely. Yeah, you know him.
There you go.
Hilarious.
So, Steve, I joked earlier with you about that military precision that was drilled into you for all the years you were in the service, but it sounds like you have put that to good use while you're plotting your books. Do you?
I think I do. I'm very organized with it, but in a military fashion, I've always believed that flexibility is the key. No plan survives first contact. That's like the old
right.
adage.
Sure.
So that's why I use a very flexible method when plotting, but I do spend a lot of time getting that plan together. So yeah, I'd say it does. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, Steve. Is there a book that you particularly like so much that you've read more than one time?
There's this guy named Tom Abrams. I think I've read his book. I do, so I could turn around.
Wait a minute, that
Stephen
huge
King.
Sucking sound you hear is Steve's lips on the phone. Let's try that again, okay? Is there, because I know you two have a mutual admiration society, as I do for both of you. Is there a book that you've read that you go to once a year and you say, I just got to read it one more time. It's that good.
I do. I absolutely love Stephen King's The Dark Tower series.
There you go.
It's, there's lots of, it's a long series, so I don't obviously get through it. Like, I don't say, hey, I'm going to read The Dark Tower series. But every time
I read through
the books, I get something. There's so much that I missed the first time I've read through in the second and third and fourth. So I would say.
That's exciting, isn't it? It's exciting.
That's awesome. And it stands for any of Stephen King's earlier books. I'll reread over and over again.
There you go. Tom, I want to pose the same question to you. I know that your life on air and your life traveling around as a journalist, a television journalist, keeps you away from reading as much as you really would like to. But certainly there have to be books that stay in your mind that you think, you know what, I'm keeping this, and once a year I'm pulling it out and I'm going to read it because it's that damn good. What is that book?
Michael Crichton's Sphere is one of my favorite. Michael Crichton's Andromeda Strain, George Orwell's Animal Farm. Those are probably my three favorite books.
How amazing. Good for you. Tom, what book is on your nightstand right now that you're reading?
Well, I have my iPad, which has a bunch of books on it. But the one that I'm referencing a lot right
reading?
Now, while I'm rereading the first book in Nick Smith's Extinction Cycle series, Extinction Horizon, I think, is the very first one, because I'm writing in it. So I'm going back and rereading over and over again to make sure that I'm consistent with what it is he wrote. I've already read it, I think, three times. So.
Fabulous. Steve, whose book is on your nightstand that you're reading?
Great question. I'm reading Jack Higgins' The Eagle Has Landed. I haven't read Jack Higgins in a number of years.
But what a book to read, though.
It's been so long since I've read any of his stuff, and I've just kind of hit this Jack Higgins revival. He has so many books, and I could never need another book again. But there is another Tom Abrams book coming out in November called Space Magic.
You'll be reading.
I'll have to read.
Yes.
Yeah.
To you both, I posted today that BookBub was doing a special on a Dashiell Hammett book. No, I take it back. Not a Dashiell Hammett. They're doing a special on, and I'll give you the exact name of the book. Hold on. Raymond Chandler's Trouble Is My Business. That book is on sale right now through BookBub for $1.99. Does Raymond Chandler fit into your writing at all, Steve?
No.
Okay. Tom?
Sorry.
He did the very first book I wrote, which was a crime thriller. But a guy who Michael Connelly does fit in in part because he critiqued my first non-published novel, and so I have like an 11-page critique from him that I reference frequently. So, you know, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, Raymond Chandler kind of fits.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, for sure, Michael Connelly, one of my favorite authors of all time. Tom, my question to you is, and I want you to clear your mind, you are not a television journalist. You are not a writer. In another existence, you were born and you've decided to become what? In your wildest dreams.
A professional golfer.
Really? How cool is that?
You chase the sun all year round. So.
You do. That is true. And you are in a perpetual state of frustration because, but for one stroke, it could always be better, right?
Exactly. And I'm horrible at golf, so that's the other reason.
Steve, forget the military. Forget the fact that your wife has told you exactly how smart and not smart you are. You are not writing books because I know she is your inspiration for everything and your acknowledgments and your dedication. There you are standing and you're thinking, no, but I got it. You know, I got it. Believe me, I've read your books enough. You're standing there thinking, what the hell do I want to do? Here's what I want to do. What is it?
I'd like to be a mercenary protecting wildlife reserves in Africa. I had some time to think about that one.
Okay, there you go. It works for me. last question, Steve. What's the best piece of advice you ever got?
I think it's my dad.
For anything.
Seeing him, I think it's from my dad. He never seemed to get riled up. He'd get riled up, but he never overreacted. And I think I've always taken that. I've gotten very fired up and riled up, and I always take a step back and don't let it get to me too much.
even though it does.
Good for you. Good for you. Tom, you've been in a lot of pressure cooker situations, and you've seen a lot of people lose it. You're under a deadline. However, the best piece of advice you ever got about life was?
I think the best piece of advice was actually someone telling me I couldn't do something.
Wow. Nothing like motivation, right?
Right.
Good for you. I want to thank Tom Evans and Steve Conkley for being on the show tonight. I've so enjoyed listening to you two. I want listeners and readers to drop me a note over on Facebook or on email at pam@authorsontheair.com. Don't you think Steve and Tom should come back once a month and do a show? I do. I want to thank you both for being with me. I posted on my page in Facebook for Pam Stack. They're books. They're post, you know, they're dystopian books. But don't let that stop you. Go to Amazon and put in both their names. Get their books. Please, please leave a review. Nothing more frustrating than having a good book out there and not leaving a review. Do that. It's the right thing. Have a great weekend, everyone. Tom and Steve, you're the best. I cannot thank you for being here for Authors in Conversation. Come back, will you both?
Sure will.
Will
Thanks,
do.
Pam.
Thanks,
thank
Pam.
Thank you so much. Have a great night. Good night. Good night.
You too.
And good night, listeners. You are wonderful. I thank you for being here, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.